On this week's 51%, we'll hear a few thoughts from former President Jimmy Carter on gender equality. Then, Ebola has left thousands of orphans in one African country. And from this, we'll try and face the music.
I would much rather be doing this and taking the risk that, you know, one day my hearing's going to go all together and I won't be able to do it anymore, than work at a job I hated because I was scared that I was going to lose my hearing.
And we'll get to know some women who are in male-dominated music professions. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. With the help of God and true friends, I come to realize I still have two strong legs. Former President Jimmy Carter recently spoke at Yale University about his latest book, and as 51%'s Jim Lavoulis tells us, President Carter touched on the issue of gender equality.
President Carter's new book is titled A Call to Action: Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. The 90-year-old Nobel Peace Prize winner says the societal status of women today reminds him of the separate but equal standard that applied to blacks and whites in the U.S. for a century.
People who were white, and I would say quite liberal, went along with this economic and political benefit silently because the white folks didn't want to change their privileged status. And the same thing is taking place now around the world, including in this country, in the derogation or subjugation of women and girls.
President Carter, who has had the longest post-presidency in history, is known today for his humanitarian work around the globe in the decades since he left office in 1981. Much of the work has been done through the Carter Center, which he and his wife started in 1982. In describing his latest book, President Carter says female inferiority is found in beliefs central to one's life, such as religion. He does not criticize religion, but instead those teaching it, often men.
And if an employer wants to hire men and women in his business, knowing that God looks upon women as inferior, he feels much less guilt if he pays men more than women.
President Carter described other parts of the world where girls face genital mutilation, while the number of people sold into slavery, often for sex, exceeds the levels in the 18th and 19th centuries. Carter says every month 200 to 250 people pass through Atlanta, home to one of the world's busiest airports, and are sold into slavery. Gender inequality affects America's universities and its military, the nation's two most respected institutions, according to President Carter.
1 out of 10 girls who enter an American university will be raped before she graduates. 1 out of 5 will be sexually assaulted, that is, approached in a suggestive sexual way without her permission. But most university administrators, deans, presidents, and others don't want it to be known that on their campuses these things take place. And when it comes to a choice between an effective football player and a freshman girl, the football player is more valuable to keep on the college campus.
President Carter says 90% of campus sexual assaults are committed by 4% of the student body, while 41% of American universities have not reported a single case of sexual assault in the past 5 years. He says that creates a sense of impunity for serial rapists. President Carter says there has been progress, with 15% of Congress comprised of women compared to 3% when he was in office. He says ending gender inequality is a challenge to a long-standing tradition, just like slavery.
This is a problem for us to face. The question is, do we have the courage to do it? Do we men want to give up the special privileges that we have of having the most tenured professors and the most presidents of colleges and the most chief executive officers and the highest salaries and so forth?
During the question and answer session, President Carter brought up a Huffington Post article reporting that 6 Yale students were found guilty of non-consensual sex in 2013, but not one was expelled.
You know, you can just warn a boy and chastise him. That doesn't help. But yeah. The expulsion is a very difficult thing for a university to accept as a policy. Yeah.
Yale President Peter Salovey, seated next to President Carter asking him questions, responded.
I think our policies and procedures have changed over the last year or two.
I'm not surprised.
See different outcomes.
For 51%, I'm Jim Lavoulis.
Imagine a child who lost both parents and who cannot afford to eat. There are at least 2,000 orphans, thousands more who are undocumented, who are now homeless as a result of the Ebola epidemic in the West African country of Liberia. Julius Kanuba reports.
Three of my parents passed away. As for now, there is nobody to help me for my education.
17-year-old Massa Masakwe lost her mother, father, and uncle to the deadly Ebola virus. She was the only one in her family to survive, but her life has been shattered.
Life is difficult. I was not to myself. Well, I'm not seeing my mother. I'm not happy.
The parents of Jeremiah Cooper and his little sister, Mercy, also succumbed to Ebola, as did their youngest brother. Jeremiah, who is 17, and his 14-year-old sister, Mercy, told me they are devastated by the death of their parents, as life has become very complicated for them.
Life very difficult for us since my people passed away.
Life is very difficult for us since my people passed away. I'm not feeling fine. Sometimes I always think about them. I'm feeling so bad. Now, as I'm talking to, tears want to come down from my eyes. When I think about them, I feel so hurt. I will always miss them.
I'm always missing.
I'm not feeling fine. Somehow people need to.
I am not feeling fine since my people died. What they used to do for me, no other person can do for me. So when I think about them, it makes me cry.
Thinking about them can make me cry.
Jeremiah and Mercy are now living with one of their uncles in a new environment after being ostracized in their previous community. Jeremiah explains.
My community our influence.
The community I was in first, the people were afraid of us. They said we were Ebola patients. They used to refer to our house as Ebola house. So we were not free in the community.
So we're not free in the community.
An estimated 2,000 children have been made orphans in Liberia as a result of the Ebola virus. They joined the already over 2,500 orphans across the country who mostly lost their parents during the Civil War, which ended in 2003. Their well-being and even survival are seriously at risk in poverty-stricken Liberia, according to child rights campaigner Amos Sobo, who runs the local advocacy group Orphan Concern Liberia.
Many of them, their situation is very, very deplorable. Imagine a child who lost both parents, who cannot even afford to eat, yet they are being left with family members with nothing to show. That becomes a serious challenge to the rest of the family members.
Amos said that action is urgently needed to give the children orphaned by Ebola a perspective for their future.
That was Julius Kanuba reporting for Africa Link. Next, Rachel Wong from KALW brings us a story about a musician who, going deaf, fights for a life in music.
From the moment Sandy Mix wakes up in the morning, she's thinking about music. Over coffee, she plans the day's lessons.
I can't believe how lucky I am, because, you know, everybody wants to do the thing that they love and hardly anybody gets to do it. I am a music teacher, primarily piano, and also trumpet and French horn and voice. I teach a little voice.
The way Mix talks about teaching music, you might think it's all she's ever done. But only a few years ago, she worked in a very different field, information technology.
It was a horrible, horrible job, and I won't talk any more about it, but it paid me a lot of money. Then finally I realized, you know what? I'm tired of doing this thing with computers.
She taught music lessons on the side for a while, and then she made the leap.
Oh yeah, everything's in here. This is where I teach.
Now she's fully booked, with a waiting list.
But I have about 42 students. About 75% of them are adults, and about 25% are kids.
One of her students, Diane Wilson, arrives for her lesson.
Hey there.
Hi there, it's nice out.
Yes.
You know, she's been taking lessons for about 2 years. She's amazing. So let's sing it while you play the left hand.
Okay.
I'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2. Da, 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 da. I'm always having epiphanies in lessons about things. You know, it's like, oh, well, let's try it this way, or let's do it that way, or, oh, I never knew that. You know what? Do this first.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You got it. All right, so this measure...
Mix has always had a gift for music.
Everybody has that thing they're really good at, and this was the thing that I was good at.
She majored in music in college. Then in her 20s, Mix started to have trouble hearing. Eventually, it was too disturbing to ignore.
I was just, you know, lying in bed at night, and I'm like, what is going on with my ears? You know, it's like, why are my ears ringing?
That ringing was a small part of a much bigger problem.
The type of hearing loss I have is high-end sensorineural hearing loss. And what that means is that my high-end hearing completely gone.
And the rest is going, too. Her hearing aids compensate for the loss, but not completely.
When I'm learning a new piece, I have to learn it down in an octave where I can hear it. When it gets much higher, like C6, then it becomes, I hear the percussive sound of the key more than I hear the note.
At some point, her hearing aids will no longer help, and she'll have to quit teaching music. But she still hopes to make music.
This is what I'm really trying to get jobs doing, like, accompanying gigs and things like that, or, you know, cocktail music, things that I can do that I don't necessarily have to hear very well for.
After all, a very famous musician composed some of his most notable work after going deaf, Ludwig van Beethoven.
From what I understand, that's how Beethoven did a lot of his... He had like a balloon, basically, on the piano, and that's how he could feel the vibration. Well, I wonder if I put my hand on my throat when I sing, I can feel the vibrations and try to associate the vibration with where I am, pitch-wise. So it's like, ah, just again, ah, the vibrations change in your throat. I mean, obviously I'm not Beethoven, but it can be done.
But Mix admits that big questions do haunt her.
Sometimes I lay awake at night going, well, what am I doing? What am I doing? You know, it's like, this could all go. And I'm like, brain, what? It's like, you can't do anything about it, especially not right now at 2:30 in the morning. This is one of those things where it's like, you can spend all your time being pissed off at the irony, being angry at the irony of, you know, it's like, here I am given this wonderful, you know, musical ability. And sorry, but you're going to lose your hearing.
But when the sun rises, she knows she still gets to play music all day.
I would much rather be doing this and taking the risk that, you know, one day my hearing's going to go altogether and I won't be able to do it anymore than work at a job I hated because I was scared that I was going to lose my hearing. I made this work. I will continue to make it work.
Because music is more than work. It's fun, especially with friends. Mix may not always be able to hear music, but with some luck, she'll always be able to feel it. In San Francisco, I'm Rachel Wong for Cross Currents.
Emily McWilliams comes from a family of musicians. She has been playing the piano for 20 years and composes songs for her partner's New Orleans metal band. Piano tuning was never high on her list of professional aspirations, but with the help of a good teacher, she's come to realize it can be as challenging and precise a process as playing the songs themselves. Nina Feldman brings us the story.
Growing up in New Orleans, Emily McWilliams always thought she'd be a piano player.
I've played the piano since I was 7 years old, so for a little over 20 years now. Growing up, I was always just playing alone, playing in my room, playing for my piano teacher, playing for my recital. I always thought that I would maybe do something with my more artistic sides, writing music, composing.
As she grew older, Emily realized that might not be sustainable. She'd always worked office jobs to make ends meet, but the prospect of having to abandon the world of music for a life of routine administrative work sounded grim. So she did the one thing she thought she never would.
I think it was one of those things, you know, I'm not going to do what my parents did, you know, for a very long time. I thought, there's no way I'm going to do this.
The way you start with one note, which is the A above middle C. And when it's in tune, it's at A440, which means it vibrates at 440 vibrations a second. That's concert pitch.
This is Emily's dad, Matthew McWilliams. Originally a trumpet player, he's been tuning pianos in New Orleans since 1976. And he's taught Emily everything she knows.
Normally, and do correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, Dad, you tune A4. So you would set that to a tuning fork. And then you would tune what is referred to as the temperament, which is...
The whole piano is built around a good, solid temperament.
Basically a two-octave range close to A440.
And you can expand out to the treble section or to the bass section, whichever direction you want to go.
This is a G. So I just muted off the right string.
How do you know when you've gotten it in tune? It's all because of this listening to beats. If I'm listening to beats, I'm measuring one pitch against another pitch, trying to find an exact spot where that interval is calm. And there's only one spot where it's at its calmest.
If you hear two that are, they should be the same. It'll get, I mean, you can kind of hear that wave there, you know?
But I can hear the beats. I couldn't right away.
To get it in tune, you kind of
I had to kind of approach it much more technically, I guess, than like a musical ear. It's a different kind of listening.
Because of the actual physical control of the hammer. He knows exactly when to stop moving it, and I haven't quite gotten there yet.
Emily's been training under her dad for the past 3 years, but she's not taking any paying clients yet. To pass the test required by the Piano Technicians Guild to become a registered piano tuner, you have to be able to tune a piano in under 2 hours. Right now, she's logging in at about 4. Matthew, though, is a pro.
How many pianos do you tune a day right now?
I average 4. That's a comfortable day. But there's days where I'll do 5 or 6, and I've done as many, I think the most I've ever done was 12. That's torture.
This is a guy who makes a lot of house calls.
No, I was in this house where, the man is elderly. He has an amazing piano. It's a 9-foot concert grand, and, he's very particular, but he's become ill, where he's pretty much bedridden. So he has a helper at his house. And the helper, I think, is there just to help him. But the rest of the house has become a total wreck. I mean, there's music all over the place. You can't hardly turn around. And the whole time I'm tuning this, I'm wondering, why does he want the piano tune? Because he can't get up and play it himself. So I'm not sure. It's one of two things. Either he has somebody else that comes there and plays, or more than likely, he just wanted to hear the piano being tuned. I think that that's probably the case. And he's a composer. You know, he's written a lot of choral music through the years. So I'm just suspecting that he may have wanted company.
For Matthew, piano tuner is a title that just feels natural. And apparently he's not the only one who thinks so.
It was the first Super Bowl after 9/11. There was a piano that was at the convention center, and I was told to be there at a certain time, go to such and such doors, and I thought the credentials getting in the convention center then were almost impossible. I didn't have a pass. I didn't have anything. I thought, you watch, I'm going to go here to tune this piano, and they'll look at me and laugh and tell me to go the other way because they wouldn't let anybody in then after 9/11. So I'm walking up to the door. Here comes a man walking out, and he opens the door. He says, you must be the piano tuner. And I'm thinking, why am I the piano tuner? So I don't know what stereotype that is, but I must look like the piano tuner.
For Emily, though, it's not quite so simple.
Women piano tuners, as far as I know, particularly in New Orleans, there aren't a lot. That's probably pretty normal, at least in the United States. I think that's awesome and an opportunity for me to get into a profession that is mostly male-dominated.
She'll get her chance soon enough.
My dad's business is so huge that he has to reference other piano tuners in the city because he can't fit them in his schedule half the time. So it's convenient. I think it's going to actually be perfect, yeah. Particularly pianists, I think they know how they want their instrument to sound. And it varies from person to person. You know, some people might want a warmer sound. Some people might want a brighter sound. Some people might want the treble stronger than it might be. So that's where a good seasoned tuner like my dad can really tweak each string, each note, and deal with each piano as it is.
She'll get that, but that takes time.
This piece was produced by Nina Feldman as part of the 24-hour radio race from KCRW's Independent Producer Project.
Conducting is a predominantly male world. Sarah Elzis produced this profile of Paris-based American conductor Elizabeth Askren Brie, who has fought sexism throughout her career.
Orchestral conducting in particular has been one of the most traditionalist and conservative jobs that I know of. We have the weight of our history of the art, which was exclusively male for such a long time. And then we have also the reality, which was that before the women's rights movement, I mean, before the 20th century, no woman could be in a position of power. So we're dealing with two types of very slow-moving progress. My name is Elizabeth Askren Brie. I work as a freelance conductor. I am a native New Yorker, and I've been based in Paris for the last 16 years. You can't be wishy-washy. If you're coming to meet an orchestra for the first time, then you have to get to know them. They have to get to know you. I mean, it's a dance, and you have very little time. With orchestras, you might get 3 services, maybe 4, and each service could be 2.5 to 3 hours. So that's really not much at all if you're doing a full-length program, but that's completely standard. So you really have to be extremely efficient. You've got to get right to the meat of the matter to build a collective interpretation of the pieces that you're going to play. I had my first experience conducting when I was 16. I was very intrigued that you could indirectly influence with a series of movements that kind of combine sport and dance and physical architecture, and you can transmit that to other musicians who would interpret that and create music in a certain way. I was really lucky because there was a teacher who was a conductor, Rebecca Scott, and she saw something in me that she wanted to encourage. She and another professor really gave me those first opportunities where somebody in the profession said, you know, you could do this. Traditionally, in musical circles, you know, you transmit your energy and your vision to the next generation, but you choose somebody because you feel that affinity. So if you don't have somebody who can naturally see that in you, then you have to work extra hard to show them that despite this very apparent difference, that you can go past that. There are definitely moments of I'm hanging it up or I could do something else. I'm not quite sure that it was directly because of a comment, a sexist comment, but just because of the general difficulty. I mean, it is almost insurmountable sometimes. This profession is extremely difficult for anybody. There are so few posts, and I think it's a slippery slope to go on to always say, oh, poor me, it's because, you know, I'm this, or that because they didn't allow me to. It may or may not be the case, but that's not helpful in getting where you want to be. Everybody has a different way of coming to terms with the fact that you're a minority in your professional setting, but I like to think that you can't avoid it. You're different, but then once you've accepted it and you say, yeah, that's right, I'm a woman, I have maybe a different body language or whatever it is, then you just get past it and you say, I'm here to make music. And I have very rarely had problems with the musicians in the orchestra because it is about the music making, and the musicians know that.
That was conductor Elizabeth Askren Brie in a profile produced by Sarah Elsis for Radio France International. And that ends the music for this week's show. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1325.